Meet the CXO. Wir reden, was verbindet.
Hello, dear guests, and welcome. This fireside chat is going to be held by Claudia Nemat, who's been a member of the Deutsche Telekom's executive board since October 2011. And since January 2017, Claudia has been responsible for the technology and innovation division, in which networks, products, IT, and security expertise is brought together. Tonight, Claudia will be interviewing Benedict Evans, who has spent the last 20 years analyzing mobile, media, and technology, and has worked in different fields, equity research, strategy, consulting, and venture capital at Andreessen Horowitz in Silicon Valley. And today he's working as an independent analyst. We're very excited that he's here tonight to share some of his thoughts and insights. Claudia and Benedict, for the next 30 minutes, are going to be talking about the current trends, the current topics that are shaking up the tech industry, are going to take a closer look at these hot topics and debates, and yeah, share their thoughts on them. So please, big round warm applause to both Claudia and Benedict.
Benedict, I think everyone is so curious to listen to you. You and I, we talked already yesterday.
Yes.
And we were saying that this fantastic industry every year seems to produce a new big scheme. Right now, it's about the large language models. I think last year it was the metaverse, and then the year before it was cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, no, we don't talk about that.
No, we don't talk about that anymore. So from your point of view, what's the hottest shit?
Well, so, I mean, I sometimes say that the tech industry kind of suffers from a sort of Tourette syndrome. And instead of shouting a swear word at inappropriate moments, it's voice or machine learning or 5G. And, you know, more sort of systemically, though, you have this sort of fundamental cycle that lasts sort of 10 or 15 years that's the center of the tech industry. And so it was PCs from like the mid-80s to the late 90s, and then it was the web for 15 years, and then it was smartphones for sort of, you know, say 2010 until today, more or less. And smartphones are boring. Smartphones happened. We understand how they work. All the white space in providing smartphone applications got filled in. Even the last 5 years, people in tech have been saying, well, okay, smartphones happened. Now what? And so is it voice? Is it bots? Is it a new kind of social? Is it maybe VR? And then we get this kind of bizarre word metaverse, which became a sort of a Rorschach blot on which anyone could project anything that they could think of that might happen in the next 10 years. And then sort of Web3 again, which are, you know, kind of joking apart, VR and Web3 are both kind of interesting technologies, but they're not really close to kind of consumer adoption yet. 2013-14, we had this wave around machine learning that's now sort of been absorbed into every big company. And, you know, Deutsche Telekom and everybody here has 20 projects deploying machine learning, and we understand it. And now we have another wave of machine learning in the form of which you could call large language models or generative machine learning, which really sort of in the last 6 months, we kind of went from, oh, I suppose that's kind of interesting, to people kind of walking around going, oh my God, this is amazing. This is a fundamental breakthrough. This is the only thing anybody will be working on for the next 10 years. Kind of long pause. Yes, but what exactly do we do with it? And what
absolutely
does it mean?
Benedict, listening to you, it seems that human beings seem to have the desire to actually not talk to each other, but find a new way of talking to the machine, yeah, which is the metaverse about, the large language model is about. So would you say this type of conversation could be the next thing, or is it, you consider this more of a transformative hype?
So I think when you look at something like ChatGPT, you're seeing four or five different things going on, and one of them is natural language processing, which is you can talk to it as opposed to kind of having to kind of click on buttons to get it to do something. And I think you could certainly see each of the kind of platform shifts that we've had in the past as being a change in how we interact with computers. So certainly the web was partly expanding what, you know, services you could create, but it was also made it much easier to deploy software. And you could absolutely see multi-touch smartphones as a step change in the level of abstraction of how we talk to a computer. It's much easier to use a smartphone than to use a Windows PC or a Mac. But I mean, I think the kind of the core shift, for want of a better term, generative ML, is there's a broad class of problem that is hard for people to do, but easy for people to explain. So it's easy to explain how a telco billing system works. Well, so bad example. Is it easy to explain? Well, okay, European billing system, yes. American may be different. It's easy to explain how you would calculate a mortgage, but it's hard to do it 1,000 times a second. And so that was something that was very easy to calculate with computers in the 60s and 70s. But then there's another class of problem where it's easy to do, but very hard to explain how you do it. So how can you tell that that's a cat and not a dog? How can you tell that that credit card transaction looks suspicious? And you think it's easy until you try and write it down, and it turns out that it's incredibly difficult. And so this is the problem that machine learning solved in sort of 2013-14, which is you turned it from a logic problem into a statistics problem, and that turned out to work really well, and suddenly you actually can recognize cats, and you can recognize fraudulent credit card transactions, and you can plan a network much more efficiently. And so you can do this kind of broad class of a problem. Now, the kind of the wave that's happening now is sort of running those same models in reverse. So if the last wave of machine learning was, now I can recognize a cat, then the current wave of machine learning is, now I can make more pictures of cats, or I can make more network plans, or I can design new user interfaces, or I can write more code, or I can write new biographies, I can create new stuff. And so you go to ChatGPT and you write, give me a biography of Benedict Evans, and it says, Benedict Evans is a tremendously influential thought leader, which is correct. And and then it says, Benedict Evans went to Oxford, which I didn't, and worked at McKinsey, which I didn't, and worked from Andreessen Horowitz from 2012, wrong date, and has written several books. No, I haven't. And so if you don't know me and know anything about me, and why would you, the biography looks really good. It looks exactly like what a biography of someone like me tends to look like. But it's not actually my biography. And so this is sort of the error rate inherent in a statistical system, but it means everyone in tech is kind of sitting and looking at this and thinking, okay, it's tremendously good at replicating patterns. It's not necessarily very good at replicating exactly a factual thing. So if you ask it, make me a picture of Joe Biden on horseback, it will make you a picture of Joe Biden on horseback. If you are an expert on horses, you'll look at the muscles and go, the muscles are all wrong. But we don't really care. If you ask it to give me a definition of, do I have appendicitis, it will do something that looks convincing, but it might be wrong. So we're kind of trying to work out, like, you can ask it for something, and it will give you something that looks like what you asked for. But that's not quite the same as giving it what you asked for. So what is that useful for?
So does that mean that for the majority of the folks, the answer would be just good enough because the person it describes is close to you? But if someone really wants to understand what you did, it's actually pretty bad.
Well, so I think that you could kind of do a 2x2 matrix here of, does the error rate matter and can I spot the error rate? So if you were to use it to, for example, so GitHub has launched a thing called Copilot where it will write code for you. And if you are a software developer and it writes the code, you can look at the code and see what's right and what's wrong, but it still saved you a huge amount of time. I was having a drink earlier tonight with a friend of mine who said he used it to write school application letters explaining why social justice was tremendously important for his three-year-old. And, you know, wrote a really, really good application letter. And he can kind of look at it and change the bits that are wrong. If you were to use it for something where it matters that it's wrong and you can't see that it's wrong, then that's a problem. But if you're using it for something where either you can tell the mistake or the mistake doesn't matter, then it becomes very useful. And so, you know, I think everyone is kind of trying to work out, to think about it. But where we seem to be going is that it works extremely well in vertical applications, where the expert or the person who understands what it is using it. It might not work so well for search, because then you're asking about stuff you don't know anything about.
Absolutely. Would you then say one of the most relevant capabilities going forward would be the capability to deal with those models, to probe them correctly and ask the right questions and figure out how to deal with the answers?
Well, so I suppose, again, it depends on the domain. You know, if I go to Google and say, what are the symptoms of appendicitis, I shouldn't need to know how to ask that question. I mean, I should sort of vaguely be able to understand which of the results is likely to be reliable, but I shouldn't have to know how to use Google. I should just have to be able to ask. If, on the other hand, I'm going to use it to generate a network deployment plan for, like, a 6G radio system, then, yes, I should understand what kind of question to ask, and I should understand how to assess the kind of results that might come back, which is obviously what people have been experimenting with for the last sort of 5 years or so. So there is this wonderful phrase, prompt engineering, which is, what exactly do you type into the prompt? And it turns out that, like, going to Stable Diffusion and saying, give me a cool picture, is actually not a good prompt. And the people who produce, like, amazingly interesting creative pictures, the prompt turns out to be three paragraphs of text. Because you have to get actually very, very specific as to what it is that you want in order to use this. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, there's a group of people who look at using these systems to make images and say this is terrible and destroys creativity and so on. And to me, that's like kind of looking at a camera and saying this destroys creativity.
Yes. Like, but by the way,
you have to know where to point the camera.
Benedict, I need to ask you a typical European question. Do you think it makes human beings either more stupid or, if not that, less romantic because you outsource the writing of a love letter, if you do it anyhow, yeah, to that model?
Well, I mean, it's a French play that describes somebody outsourcing the writing of a novel, so we won't talk about the French in this conversation. I think what all of these tools do is, there's a great phrase from Steve Jobs where he said, a computer is a bicycle for the mind. And, you know, a camera makes it easy for you to take a great picture of your children, but that doesn't mean that you are Cartier-Bresson. You know, I mean, there is a very successful portrait photographer in New York called Benedict Evans, who is not me. And every now and then I get an email for him saying, hey, I really loved the shoot you did with Martin Scorsese. Are you available to do Harvey Keitel? And I'm like, well, I've got a camera. You know, how hard could it be? And, of course, it is not easy at all. And that's kind of the difference. You know, yes, you can buy a camera, but that doesn't make you a photographer. And in the same sense, yet, like, yes, you can go and use Stable Diffusion and ChatGPT. That doesn't make you a writer. That doesn't make you an illustrator, or, you know, doesn't give you that creative spark to make the image.
Yesterday we had also a quick chat what it actually does in terms of how different industries can change, maybe through that. Is there any view you would have what that could mean for, we talked about retail and other industries, but any perspective on what that means for us here as telco industry?
I mean, I think the short answer is no one knows yet, and everyone's trying to work it out. I think several building blocks for looking at this. One of them is, in the last week, I've seen five different companies that are making a SaaS tool to generate different kinds of marketing collateral. So make me Instagram posts like this. Write me copy like this. This is automation. And, you know, one of the ways I used to describe machine learning is it gives you interns. Like, any of us could listen to a phone call and say the customer sounds angry, but you don't have enough interns to listen to all the calls. Well, machine learning lets you listen to all the calls. So it's automating, you know, it's a 10-year-old. A 10-year-old could do that, but you don't have infinite 10-year-olds. Well, now what machine learning also does is, you know, you get the intern to write you a summary of what happens in that document. You'd still check it. But now you have infinite interns to go and create the things that interns would create. That doesn't replace you. You still have to check what they've done. So there's a sort of a layer of automation of a certain kind of capability. I think maybe that's one way of looking at it. I think another way to look at it would be, you know, in the 1970s, every big company got a mainframe. Or the 60s, every big company got a mainframe. And that didn't just, like, automate the clerical work. It changed how you could run your business. And then the same thing in the 80s and 90s, you get PCs and you get Oracle and SAP and Microsoft. And that doesn't just change who you buy the boxes from, it changes what you can do. Like, there's stuff you can do because you're on Oracle that you couldn't do if you were running on a mainframe. And I think the same thing now happens as you move to cloud, as you move to SaaS, as you move to machine learning. You kind of, it gives you kind of new capabilities and new ways, new stuff that you could do. I mean, the challenge here is, I had this conversation with a supermarket a while ago, that, you know, imagine going to a supermarket in 1980 and saying there's this thing called SQL. And it will let you do arbitrary queries on your database now. And they would say, that's very interesting. Like what? And then there'd be a long pause. Like, what arbitrary query? What would we do? What would we ask? And now, obviously, that completely changes how supermarkets work, and it changes the inventory and the supply chain and everything else. And there's a similar point with machine learning, which was, well, now this lets you do pattern recognition. Okay, like what? What pattern recognition? And now, obviously, Deutsche Telekom and everyone else in the room could say, well, we worked out what kind of stuff we would do with this. It's not just cat pictures. And the same thing now with generative machine learning. Okay, you run the model backwards. Now you can make more of the pattern. Like what? Well, it's going to take us a while to work it out, but, you know, there's an awful lot of kind of those kinds of automation that will come again.
Okay, let's move away from the large language models to the topic where I said don't talk about it anymore. So what's your view on what happened to the crypto and NFT?
So I think the first challenge in talking about crypto is that crypto is sort of 10 or 15 different things. And so you have this kind of primary capability of you have a blockchain which has tokens, which can process transactions that can run in a distributed way. So you have like a database that's also a value system, an incentive system. What do you do with that? And so the first wave of what you might call crypto is people saying this is gold. It's digital gold. And if you live in Argentina or Iran, then the idea that you can take your entire net worth and put it on a USB stick and it can't be deflated is kind of appealing. Or inflated is kind of appealing. For most of the rest of us, like, we don't actually worry about the government stealing our money. We don't need to keep our savings in a steel box under our bed. So that's not very interesting. The second wave of crypto is, okay, what if you could put some scripting on this? So you could do a little transaction that says, if I put money in your wallet, then you pay me 3% interest. And that happens automatically, programmatically, within the system without you having to do anything or me doing anything or a lawyer having to do anything. And so you could kind of automate or program certain kinds of simple financial transactions. So you could do like an escrow system with this. You could do a mortgage system with this. And that's basically what exploded last year in both senses of the word explode, because a bunch of people kind of discovered why we have financial regulation. And why we have central banks and so on. I think the third wave of crypto, and this is kind of the thing that personally I find more interesting, is people say, well, if you could put simple software on this, maybe you could put real software on this. So maybe you could run Instagram on a blockchain. And if you ran Instagram on a blockchain, then no one would own it. And everything would be decentralized, and any individual post would be addressable by an API. And if I was an influencer and I sold a sponsored post, then the people who bought the sponsored post could see the metrics as I posted it. And the money that they paid me could programmatically come into my account, and 10% of it could go to the people who run the infrastructure. It would all be running as a single sort of automated mechanistic system, kind of like a piece of clockwork. And that gets a lot of people very excited. It's also a very kind of religious view. It's a lot like the way people used to talk about open source 20 years ago. Like, people who were working on open source thought they were going to destroy Microsoft and buying software was evil. But deep within that is this sort of interesting way, idea of like a different architecture for writing software that would mean like you would replace Instagram or YouTube.
So you mean this is about hacking the evil system of the monopolies?
Well, no, you just create new monopolies in exciting new ways. But there is some of that.
Oh, we come
yes,
to that.
There is absolutely some of that. There is this sort of very religious view, as there was in the 90s, like selling software is evil. Software should be free. Software is speech. It's wrong to sell software for money. We're going to destroy Microsoft. And here we are 25 years later. The entire tech industry runs on open source, and yet Microsoft is still there in a big company. And so you kind of have to separate the religion from it. But yeah, so it's absolutely that sense that this would kind of change how internet software platforms worked. And kind of decentralize them in interesting ways.
I have to say, I love that notion. Let me just ask you one question, because it was one of the big topics here in the GSMA, and that was around Quo Vadis Europe. Wake up call for tech leadership in Europe, if any. Yeah, so the general sentiment was, okay, more and more economic power, and with that, innovative power gets being transferred either to the United States or is being created there, not gets being transferred. It's being created there, either there or in China. So what's your view on Europe's chances, if any?
Well, so it's an interesting challenge. I mean, so for the entire length of my career, online advertising in the UK was bigger than France and Germany combined, and e-commerce the same. And so if you're trying to build an e-commerce company in Europe, if you're trying to build an e-commerce company in Spain, that's going to be really hard. And we know, for as much as people talk about Europe as being a single market, you kind of can't launch like a food delivery service in Spain and then it will just work in Germany. It's going to be different because Germans are different to Spanish people for all sorts of reasons. And so you have this sort of challenge that you don't have one market, you've got lots of separate markets. You have this challenge that digital adoption by consumers and by companies is just lower for lots of reasons. And so generally it's been very hard to build one big global internet platform company in Europe because you don't have that giant market that you can go direct to. That said, there are big tech companies in Europe. You know, ASML basically is a kind of the central pivot point of the entire semiconductor industry. So you do have those things. But in a sense, kind of part of kind of what's happened is I think people get very focused on sort of half a dozen companies and sort of forget that every year there's sort of 4,000 or 5,000 software startups created. Like every year, There's 4,000 or 5,000 software startups created in the world. And yes, 3,000 of them are in Silicon Valley. That's like the global cluster. But we kind of spend too much time worrying about Google and Facebook and Microsoft and don't think about Shopify, which is in Canada, or Deliveroo or ASML, or like all the next layer down, which are like 5, 10, 20, $50 billion companies as well.
What you're saying about the following theory, often these global leaders are also being created in smaller countries, like you said, ASML, or if you think about the giants in Switzerland or in Scandinavia, right? Or in large countries. Reason could be if you have a market like China or the US, the market is big enough to scale at the first place. But if you happen to be in a tiny place or relatively small place, you are forced to scale on the global market from the beginning. The problem is Germany, France, Italy, Spain, UK.
Yeah, so there's absolutely a story about Israel or Scandinavia that you have to go international from day one because your domestic market is too small. There's also a story in China and to some extent Japan and South Korea that your domestic market is big enough and also so different that it's actually very hard to go. It's very hard to leave. Yeah. So China is protected. Japan is not so much that it's protected. It's just like the market works in such a specific way that it's actually very hard to take a Japanese consumer model and then make it work anywhere else. You have exceptions, but you know it's difficult. And Europe tends to be kind of in the middle in that it's sort of easy, relatively easy for foreign giants to enter and also quite hard to build a domestic giant. So you definitely do have that dynamic. And as you say, for smaller countries, it's kind of easier. But there is also this dynamic that, you know, the UK digital sector, whether it's cloud adoption or online e-commerce or advertising, is basically a third of Europe. And so, you know, for all sorts of different reasons, the UK is still probably a much better place to try and build a consumer internet company than Spain, yeah, just because of that level of adoption.
So before we get too depressed about Europe, so one last question. So to warm up, what's your advice? What advice would you give to us as tech and innovation community? What should we try to hack, to actually try to attack, try to create some disruption upon it?
The big shift is just the sense that creating startups is a sensible, interesting thing to do and a normal thing to do. And I think that's what you see at something like 4 years from now, down at the old Fiera site. This is a sort of an attempt to create the sense that startups are a normal thing. And so, you know, if you're in Silicon Valley and you say, I did a startup and it didn't work, that's okay. If you are, you know, there's other parts of Europe where you did a startup and, like, you know, this is like something in a 19th century novel, you know, you've gone bankrupt and you're cast into the outer darkness. And, you know, there are countries in Europe where it's extremely difficult to pay people with stock options. You know, I hear that it's still very difficult to give people stock options as a startup in Germany.
Yes.
And so there's a way of thinking about the startup as like an innovation, like kind of like a joint stock company. That a startup is a way of creating a company. It's a way of experimenting to create companies. And making it easy and natural and normal to do that, as opposed to regarding it as this sort of weird, amazing, weird, strange California thing, is probably a good idea. After that, you know, industrial policy is hard. Trying to create innovation is difficult. There is the joke that France doesn't have a word for an entrepreneur, but, you know, I remember working for a German company and getting a calendar that said fun from 4 to 5 o'clock. And, you know, trying to kind of schedule innovation can be difficult, but removing barriers to it is a lot easier. You know, removing tax laws that say you can't pay people with share options, for example, seems like an easy thing to do.
Yeah, in Germany we have words like Vorruhestandsregelung, etc. Yeah. But anyhow, I would say before people freeze to death, I think we have to come to an end because more and more people wrap up themselves in. And I guess you and I don't want to be guilty for whatever, 60 people being ill. So for sure not. Still worth it. Yeah, that's actually good. Thank you, first of all, very much to being here with me. So thank you very much.